Expletives and threats to drop more bombs. That was President Trump's weekend. The vice president says he was provoked by Iranian trash talking. Welcome to the world of social media diplomacy. There is a cancer crisis in Iowa. The Republican and Democratic nominees for governor agree on that. Who is to blame? Democrat Rob Sand joins us. Lots of New York primaries tomorrow. One House race has become a focal point in the fight over AI regulation. Alex Boris wants more of it and explains why. Hello, everyone. I'm Major Garrett in Washington. Let me welcome you to The Takeout. Alan Greenspan, an avatar of securities trading fetishizing and central bank market intervention, died today at 100. In England, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer resigned, the sixth prime minister to step down in the 10 years since Britain voted to remove itself from the European Union, a populist flex better known as Brexit. I know what you're thinking. Where is he going with this? Please be patient. In 1996, Greenspan, who had been by then chairman of the Federal Reserve for 9 years, gave a speech in which he warned about something he called irrational exuberance. He meant the stock market then might very well be overvalued. We have a term for the massive investment in early internet companies of that era, the late 1990s, that term, dot-com bubble. It burst, proving Greenspan was onto something. Irrational exuberance returned in the years leading up to the Great Recession when, ironically, Greenspan's policies as Fed chair drove interest rates down to nearly zero. Mortgages exploded, and the buying and selling of those mortgages created, guess what? Another bubble. Irrational exuberance, some might say, was behind Brexit. British voters thought they could free Britain from Europe's regulatory overreach and accelerate prosperity. What it got instead was a sluggish economy in this gallery of short-term and largely forgettable prime ministers. So, is irrational exuberance with us anywhere today? Consider, Vice President J.D. Vance said this morning, great progress had been made in talks with Iran because, he said, Iran, after hours of negotiations, agreed to allow international nuclear inspectors inside the country. Paragraph 8 of the Memorandum of Understanding, remember that was signed last week, stipulates international inspectors will, inside Iran, supervise the downblending of highly enriched uranium. That is the fissile feedstock of a nuclear bomb. Was the war itself an exercise in irrational exuberance of gains assumed but much harder to realize? Our European allies and a good number of conservatives here at home increasingly think so. Irrational exuberance may have been behind the costly and rushed redo of the reflecting pool. It all looks so easy. What could go wrong? How about algae and the blue ballyhooed coating now floating to the surface in scabby pieces? Global tariffs, many struck down by the Supreme Court, ending birthright citizenship, very possibly soon to be struck down by the Supreme Court. Bill Pulte, a federal housing overseer with no visible expertise, acting director of national intelligence? Not even most Senate Republicans can stomach that. Examples, these, of irrational exuberance at play? Just asking. For more on the Iran negotiations and an exchange with President Trump over that and the aforementioned reflecting pool, we turn now to Ed O'Keefe at the White House. Ed, take it away.
Major, good to see you. The vice president is on his way back from Switzerland and marathon talks with Iranian, Qatari, and Pakistani officials as they try to move forward with the negotiations that are supposed to unfold here in now under 60 days. Among other things, the vice president announcing today that IAEA inspectors, International Atomic Energy Agency inspectors, are expected to return to Iran. They were there at least twice in the latter half of last year, but they'll return. He says they're building the mechanism to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, or basically ensuring that it will stay open. They're also working on ending the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon and stepping up a process for future negotiations, in essence, to keep these talks going. Among other things, the U.S. Treasury has now announced a 60-day license, basically 60 days for Iran to sell its oil to the world, including potentially to the United States. It would last until about August 21st. And the vice vice president and the president earlier floating the idea that Iranian assets could be unfrozen so that they could start spending money again, so long as most, if not all, of that money is spent on buying, in essence, American agricultural goods to feed the 91 million or so people of Iran. Now, the president spoke in the last hour after signing executive orders regarding quantum computing. We got a chance to talk to him about the Iran deal. I specifically asked regarding something the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said today, that his forces aren't leaving Lebanon anytime soon, which could end up being a key sticking point in the talks. Take a listen. Earlier today, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his forces are not leaving Lebanon. That is a sticking point in these conversations. He said it publicly in Israel.
Well, we're going to take a look at it.
Well, what would you do to make sure that he doesn't?
Well, I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do, but it gets solved. I'm a problem solver. I get problems solved real fast, including with Bibi.
You could see him slightly piqued there by the suggestion that Netanyahu is once again, at least publicly, saying that he isn't necessarily in agreement with what are the contours of the current talks. And he said he would find a way to deal with the Israeli leader regarding that. We'll wait and see if we learn anything more about a potential conversation between them. The other thing on the president's mind these days is what's going on with one of his big reconstruction projects here in Washington, of course, the reflecting pool. There had been plans in place to have the American flag blue colored bottom of the reflecting pool in place by the 4th of July next weekend, and or weekend from this weekend. And of course, in recent days, there's been evidence of tampering, if you will, and algae once again blooming in a reflecting pool that has always had algae, essentially, since it opened in the 1920s, about a 6-7 acre size pool. And we asked him again about that and listened to some of what he had to say. In April, you showed us pictures of what you were going to do at the pool, and you said you had a guy who was going to do it in a week for about $1 million. Well, it's been 2 months and $16.5 million.
I spent about 6-7 weeks, and I spent probably, in terms of outside, probably $10 million, around $10 million. They say 16, but a lot of that is workers that work for the same thing. So they were going to spend $400 million. I spent 10. They were going to spend 4 years. I spent 2 months, maybe less. And I have a better product. Now, I can't help it if somebody goes in with a knife and starts hacking it up.
He alleges someone has scraped the bottom of the pool with some kind of a knife or a razor and left a 250 to 350 foot gash. We've asked him for the proof. He suggested we could reach out to the National Park Service and the Interior Department for more details. We've done that, Major, and we're waiting to hear back.
Yes, the vandals are spoken of, but they are hard to locate. Ed O'Keefe, thank you very, very much. CBS News National Security Analyst Aaron McClain joins me now. He's also the host of the School of War podcast. Aaron, so what the vice president talked about today was procedures and mechanisms. What do those words actually mean?
Well, that's an excellent question, Major. You know, there's a lot of ins, a lot of outs to these negotiations. It can be hard to track the details. I like to look at it as, what are the fundamental objectives of both sides, and are they achieving them? The Iranians want to assert lasting control of the Strait of Hormuz. They're achieving that. It's baked into the MOU, and they are asserting that control. They want to get paid handsomely for allowing any traffic to go through. They're achieving that. Ed O'Keefe just walked us through those very broad sanctions waivers, broader than those in the JCPOA, by the
right.
way.
Right. And so this is like new policy that's more generous, at least on the sanctions front, than the Obama administration granted.
Now, in fairness, that is for 60 days
60
right
days,
now.
Agreed.
But Iran can
but
get
real money's real money.
Real U.S. dollars, Major. Real U.S. dollars. Iran was still frozen out of the U.S. dollar market during the JCPOA era. These waivers actually allow them to get paid in dollars, potentially by American companies. Also something very difficult to achieve under the JCPOA regime. So Iran...
Very quickly, JCPOA, Joint Combined Plan of Action, that's what the nuclear deal with Obama administration is referred to frequently.
Absolutely. What we want concessions on the nuclear program. We got today inspectors. As you just very well pointed out in your introduction, they already agreed to inspectors in the MOU. So we're negotiating again for something that was already conceded.
Right. And Lebanon. What Iran said today, and there's nothing that the Vice President, J.D. Vance, said today that fundamentally disagrees with this. There's now a mechanism to talk about Lebanon consistently and constantly so the Iranians can at least evaluate with the Americans what the ceasefire is or isn't accomplishing in Lebanon. And when, as Ed O'Keefe asked the president, if the Israelis don't want to withdraw, they want to have this 6 to 10 kilometer buffer zone inside southern Lebanon, that is an area of possible disagreement.
Another Iranian objective, protecting its proxy Hezbollah. By the way, ending Iran support for its terror proxies, a stated objective of the war. Now the structure of these negotiations enshrines that relationship. Iran wants to drive a wedge between the United States and Israel. Again, I would say succeeding. Every time there's fighting, even if initiated by Hezbollah, as it often is, Iran will say there's fighting in southern Lebanon. This is contrary to the provisions of the MOU. The negotiations are paused. The strait is closed. They did it over the weekend. They'll do it over and over again.
Very, very quickly, what do we know about traffic going through the Strait of Hormuz?
It paused briefly on Saturday when the Iranians said they were closing the strait as a consequence of what was going on in Lebanon. But we have seen more ships through on Sunday and Monday through these scattershot northern and southern routes.
Aaron McLean, always great stuff. Thank you very much, sir. CBS News poll just released finds most Americans want the war with Iran. Believe it or not, of course you believe it. They want it to end. And relatively few Americans believe that based on what they know so far, the U.S. has gotten the better of this new emerging framework memorandum of understanding. Joining me now, he's your friend, he's my friend, CBS News Executive Director of Elections and Surveys, Anthony Salvanto. Anthony, please, sir, break it down.
How you doing, buddy? Look, this is the takeaway right here. It's the why behind what you just said at the top. Nearly 7 in 10 Americans think that the war ends now. The U.S. has not. They are not convinced. Permanently stopped Iran's nuclear program. So that's the net out of this. The other part of it is judging and looking at what the Trump administration in their mind did to judge the impact of all this. 2/3 say they think the Trump administration did not accurately judge the impact that this would have on the world economy and, of course, gas prices, which has been the chief complaint back home, the rising gas prices and their impact. So all of this is the takeaway. Not only do people tell us that they don't think that the war was worth the cost right here, but you see, in terms of U.S. strategic interests, on balance, they don't think it was successful. So what comes away from this is, yes, maybe an ending, which yes, they want, but not necessarily one that people think is successful or satisfying, Major.
And what about the partisan breakdown, which we always try to sift with these polls, Anthony?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked, because take a look at this. Now, Republicans, yes, they have supported the president. They still do on this and so many things. But I note this really sizable 40% that says that they think that, and this is among Republicans, that the U.S. should press on until Iran gives up more. And really specifically, they don't think it's acceptable to leave the current Iranian leadership in place, as well as pressing the idea that they think Iran will still threaten their neighbors. That's what we mean by the sort of unsatisfying ending and, in their minds, unfinished business. And that's coming from inside the president's base, inside the Republican Party.
Anthony Salvanto, thank you very much. The revolving door, so it seems, at Downing Street, 10 Downing Street, keeps spinning. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer announced today he's going to step down as leader of the Labour Party and, in turn, as leader of the country. He is the sixth prime minister, as I mentioned earlier, to resign in the past decade. Starmer has been facing pressure to step aside after last month's disastrous round of local elections. He says he will leave once his successor is picked. CBS News foreign correspondent Chris Livesay joins us from London. Chris, there's a lot to unpack here. There is politics inside Britain with the Labour Party. But there is also, from an American vantage point, an Epstein factor to all of this. Remind our audience of what that is.
Indeed. Well, the Epstein factor here was a man by the name of Peter Mendelssohn. He was named by Starmer to be his ambassador to the United States. The problem is he had deep ties, it turns out, to Jeffrey Epstein. Need I say more? Now, it doesn't matter that Starmer himself didn't have ties with Jeffrey Epstein. Nobody is accusing him of that. What matters is that the name Jeffrey Epstein is so radioactive, it is one of the things that people would remember about Keir Starmer. Not the first thing on the list by any stretch of the imagination. The first thing people would remember when it came to his failings as prime minister would probably be the economy, the high cost of living, rising inflation. Rather, it was his lapse in judgment to name somebody who had these ties to Jeffrey Epstein that people would point to as being one of his failings.
And when Keir Starmer came to power, it was with a large Labour Party mandate. Has that all frittered away?
Well, Labour still has that majority, and they want to keep it. I mean, this is really why they decided enough was enough for Keir Starmer. All of this started back in, you know, about a month ago at local elections. They were abysmal for Labour, and so MPs by the dozen were coming out and calling on Starmer to start laying out a plan for his successor. And he remained defiant up until Friday, Major. He said he wasn't going anywhere. So just two, 3 days ago, he changed his tune this morning. Of course, that defiance vanished. Now, of course, we're hearing about other names within the Labour Party because, of course, they still have that majority. But in the system here in the UK, you can effectively be fired by members of your own party if they think that you've become a liability to that party, and that's basically what happened here.
Chris Livesay, appreciate it very, very much. Thank you. Still to come on The Takeout, the crowded Democratic field for New York's 12th congressional district. State Assembly member Alex Boris joins me to talk about his campaign, one day away from primary day. Also, my conversation with Iowa's Democratic nominee for governor, Rob Sand, why he thinks she can quite possibly become the state's first Democratic governor since when? Answer, 2011. Plus, an insider's account of that chaotic January in 2023. It was a Republican brawl, metaphorically speaking, that also almost became a real brawl over a possible ascendancy, which eventually happened, of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. Former aide of his, John Legansky, joins me to discuss his book on how that all went down. The Takeout returns in 90 seconds.
At DSW, we ask the important questions, like, what shoes are you going to wear? Whether you're prepping for wedding season, festival season, or just planning the ultimate vacay, the right shoes can make or break an RSVP. So own the moment. You've got big plans, and we've got just the shoes. At the perfect price, of course. Get ready to get ready with Designer Shoe Warehouse. Head to your DSW store or DSW.com today, and let us surprise you.
Welcome back to The Takeout. Tomorrow, New York City Democrats who haven't already voted early will head to the polls to choose who they want to replace retiring Congressman Jerry Nadler, kind of a force in 12th congressional district politics for a long time. The crowded field includes New York State Assembly members, Micah Lasher and Alex Boris, as well as JFK's grandson, Jack Schlossberg, and former Republican lawyer turned staunch Trump critic, George Conway. Alex Boris joins me now. Alex, welcome to the program. In some of the stories I have read about your race, you are kind of described as an AI regulatory bad boy and have gotten the therefore the ire of the AI industry, spending a lot of money against you. If you are elected to Congress, what in Washington would you do to regulate AI in ways it's not being regulated now?
Well, it's not being regulated now in almost anyway, and that's why you're seeing the states step out. For any of your viewers that have trouble sleeping tonight, on my website, I have a 43-point plan of specifics that I want to do around how we adjust our tax code to protect jobs, how we protect the climate, how we get rid of deepfakes, the investments we make to actually lead to discoveries. But the plan starts with protecting kids. Our final ad of this campaign tells the story of Adam Rain, a 16-year-old who turned to ChatGPT for homework help. And 6 months later, it had coached him into taking his own life. His parents, Matt and Maria, are true heroes who are going throughout the country to advocate for restrictions on chatbot features. Just 2 weeks ago, we passed the strongest bill to protect kids from AI chatbots in Albany. We're going to take that bill federal when I'm in Congress.
I want to talk to you about ICE and your role as an employee from 2014 to 2019 in Palantir, which at the time had contracts with the federal government. Your employment there didn't deal with the ICE-related contracts, but nevertheless, you've been criticized for working for that company and then denouncing ICE, even though you should have or maybe could have had more to do inside Palantir to stop some of the practices you now find objectionable. I'd like to get your take on all this.
My record is clear. I never worked on that project. And in fact, when Palantir shifted from the Obama administration to the first Trump administration and allowed that software to be used for deportations, I quit. The people who are spreading that criticism include three of Trump's largest mega donors, Ben Horowitz, Mark Andreessen, and Greg Brockman, who in the last filing was Donald Trump's single largest mega donor. And in a particular bit of sweet irony, one of the other founders of that super PAC is none other than Joe Lonsdale, a co-founder of Palantir. So if anyone has questions about how Palantir feels about me, I think that settles it.
You want to abolish ICE, but I want to ask you, Alex, how can you tell anyone in the 12th congressional district that's a practical promise to try to fulfill? ICE, as you know, through the reconciliation bill just signed by President Trump, is funded fully for the next 3 years. It's not going anywhere.
Well, it can legislatively be eliminated with one stroke of the pen. ICE has been around for 23 years. Yeah, Donald Trump's, and we've seen him flip-flop on lots of things before. And when he's being held accountable for the violence that he and his agents at his direction are sending into our streets, maybe there'll be a change. But if not, we'll build the political support to override that veto. I mean, Americans have turned so quickly on this issue as they have seen these masked violent thugs being sent into our streets to round up our peaceful neighbors. It has no role in a civilized society at all. And it's time that we abolish, dismantle, and prosecute ICE.
The New York mayor, Zohran Mamdani, has not endorsed in your race. He's endorsed in three other nearby House races. Do you want his endorsement?
Of course. He's already voted. He's a voter in this district. We had a really friendly call before he went to the polls, and he said he wanted to keep his focus on the three who he had endorsed, and I respect his decision in that. But I've been a partner to him when we were both in the assembly, a partner now that he's mayor, and we'll continue that partnership when I'm his congressman.
Did it sting, Alex, when Jerry Nadler endorsed your opponent, Micah Lasher?
No, I have deep, deep respect for Jerry's lifetime of service, but Micah worked for him. It would have been more news if he hadn't endorsed Micah than if he had. I look forward to sitting down with Jerry after the primary and trying to learn as much as I can from him and ensure there's a smooth transition to this office and that everyone in New York 12 gets only better service going forward.
You sound supremely confident. What's the source of that?
The conversations I've been having on the streets. Early voting the last 9 days are the best poll that exists. And I can tell you people are excited everywhere about the chance to not choose establishment, not choose entitlement, but choose effectiveness. Send someone that has a track record that was ranked as New York City's most effective new legislator to Washington, not just to deliver on the things Democrats are talking about everywhere, on Medicare for all, on abolishing ICE, on good jobs, on expanding housing, but also on tackling this issue of AI that just has not gotten addressed.
Alex Borras, I appreciate the time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, my conversation with Democratic nominee for Iowa Governor Rob Sand, why he thinks he might be able to swing Iowa back blue, left. You know what I mean, the whole thing, blue, left. You're watching The Takeout. Welcome back to The Takeout. Here is a look at what we and now you are watching this evening. CBS News has learned that the Florida Immigration Detention Center, known as Alligator Alcatraz, is closing for good. Companies hired to operate that center were notified this morning to clear the site. The last remaining detainees left the facility last week, either being transferred elsewhere or having been deported. The decision driven largely by operational costs, which we are told estimate $1.2 billion. We love many things here at The Takeout, music at the very top of that list. So we are sad to report that legendary music executive Clive Davis died today at the age of 94. Five-time Grammy Award winner and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee died of an age-related illness at his home in Manhattan. He was one time the head of Columbia Records, and he has signed a list of artists that will amaze you. Let me list them for you. Janis Joplin, Bruce Springsteen, Whitney Houston, Billy Joel, Barry Manilow, Pink Floyd, Alicia Keys, Patti Smith, Toni Braxton, Pink, Notorious B.I.G., and many, many others. Clive Davis, rest in peace. Been more than 15 years since a Democrat occupied the governor's mansion in Iowa. State Auditor Rob Sand wants to try to change that. This fall, he will face off against Republican Zach Lane, who's a businessman and a farmer from Iowa. Election forecasters, including the nonpartisan Cook Political Report, rate this as a toss-up race. Here was some of my conversation with Rob Sand earlier today. In his victory speech, your opponent, Zach Lane, said you, Rob Sand, are a captive of Iowa's agriculture and pharmaceutical interests. And that has given you reason to have a blind eye, his words, to a cancer crisis in Iowa. How do you respond to that?
I'd blink and go, what on earth is this guy talking about?
Okay.
He says a lot of things. Mm. I can't explain that. I guess at the end of the day, he's not very familiar with what's been going on in the state because he's mostly been living in Kansas.
You consider him a Kansan or an Iowan?
I think it's a fair argument. At the end of the day, he voted in Kansas in three of the last four elections. He opened up a private school down there that he was running after working full-time down there. A decade as a full-time paid political operative, also in Montana and Colorado. Most importantly, I think, is his own words. His plane at the beginning of this campaign was spent more time in Kansas than it did in Belle Plaine.
Belle Plaine, Iowa, where his family farm is.
Where he says he lives. And when he was asked about it, he said, if I'm elected, I will change my living situation and I'll be in Iowa as much as humanly possible. Which I don't think most Iowans would find particularly reassuring. I mean, that's him saying, like, yeah, this wouldn't work for that. Which leads me to ask just, why aren't you running in Kansas?
What about the cancer crisis in Iowa? Is it real? Zach Lane says there is a higher incidence of newly diagnosed cancer in Iowa than any place on planet Earth. Is that true?
That we were number one for new cancer last year. We are now number two behind, I believe, West Virginia.
He says that's because of big pharma and big ag, is it?
Well, we have a cancer crisis. He's partially right. There is a tie between nitrates and cancer. There is also a tie between pesticides and cancer. We need to do something about this. I think that's important that we do something about it. But I also think we need to acknowledge that we are the worst state for radon in America. Lung cancer is a leading cancer in Iowa, and radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States behind smoking. So yeah, he's right, and I'm right too, and we need to have a policy on that that's going to move things. I've been consistent in having done the research saying that we shouldn't be supporting immunity for pesticide manufacturers, for example. He picked a lieutenant governor nominee that supported the bill that would have provided additional immunity to pesticide manufacturers.
So there's a difference there, you would say?
Yeah.
What about the fact that Zach Lane was not the Trump-endorsed Republican, and he won? What does that tell you about the value of a Trump endorsement in Iowa?
You know, I guess that's up to voters to decide. I can tell you this. He won this primary with 37.8% of the vote. I think that a lot of folks right now are looking around wondering why are things so rough in Iowa? And when you remind them, well, we've had 10 years of one-party control and power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. They say that's right, and they're ready for change. And he, just like whoever else would have come out of that primary, is essentially representing more of the same. He wants to continue Kim Reynolds' policies.
When I look at Iowa, I have a kind of obsessive knack of paying attention to Eastern Iowa, where President Obama in 2008 and 2012 ran very strong. Mm-hmm. He ran strong in a lot of Iowa, but I'm kind of obsessed by Eastern Iowa. And then President Trump came along and reversed in some of the counties right along the Mississippi River in Eastern Iowa. There was like a 40-point swing from 2008 to 2020 or 2020.
Howard County specifically, yeah. 40 points.
Next, what is that about? First of all, from your estimate, what is that about?
Yeah.
How do you reverse it? And do you think this is a reversible year for those trend lines?
Well, look, to me, I think a lot of Iowans have had the opportunity to get to know me over the years. I do 100 public town halls, one in every single county seat in Iowa. Lee County, for whatever reason, has two. I don't argue. I just go to both. And at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of people out there who want to vote for a person they feel like they know. And Obama had an openness about him, and Trump had been a public figure for decades. I have been in all of these counties. I've been there every year. I've always announced in advance that I'm coming to town. And I think that, in my race, provides people with an understanding of me and the work that I do that gets them to a level of trust that makes them comfortable with me as a candidate for governor.
Let me talk to you about school choice. You have a report that your auditor's office put out about Iowa, its approach. It has become a bit of a topic point for Republicans nationwide. Mm-hmm. Why do you believe what Iowa's doing is wrong? And do you believe it is subsidizing wealthier Iowans at the expense of others?
Well, we know that it's subsidizing wealthier Iowans because there is no income limit on who can get this. If the folks who passed this program actually cared about school choice, they would have said, we're going to give you this much money, but you can't just throw your tuition rate up by the same amount, leaving it equally as unaffordable as it was before. They didn't do that. If the folks who supported this program actually cared about school choice, they would have said, we're going to make sure this is focused on low-income folks, and they would have an income limit. Instead, 80% of the money goes to folks whose kids would have been in private school anyway. That's the report that we put together using Governor Reynolds' own numbers.
Kim right? Reynolds.
Yeah. We're not allowed to audit how this public money is spent. There are no rules other than one, you can't pay a rebate. So there's no rules for how private schools spend public money, Major. This whole thing is a boondoggle. I was the chief public corruption prosecutor in Iowa prior to being state auditor. Mm-hmm. I prosecuted the Iowa Film Office tax credit scandal, uncovered the largest lottery rigging scheme in American history, prosecuted the only American prosecution of a Papua New Guinean Ponzi scheme that ensnared Iowans for hundreds of thousands of dollars. When I read this bill, alarm bells went off in my head.
Right.
I could read this and say, money is going to get wasted. Money is going to be abused. And yet that's the program that they put in place. I don't understand why they want to do that. We also have a $1.3 billion budget deficit, and we're sending this money to the wealthiest people in Iowa who are going to send their kids to private school anyway, when our budget is burning off our surplus at a rate of $1.3 billion a year. That's fiscally irresponsible.
Rob Sin, Democratic nominee for governor in Iowa. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for being.
Next, most Democrats, when they're asked, try to put as much distance between themselves and former President Biden. California Governor Gavin Newsom, who is quite publicly weighing a presidential bid in 2028, is doing the exact opposite and embracing Biden and the legacy. Our political panel will discuss that, plus a new argument on social media just happening right now between Elon Musk and California Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna. All that coming up here on The Takeout.
Sometimes historic events suck. But what shouldn't suck is learning about history. I do that through storytelling. History That Doesn't Suck is a chart-topping history telling podcast chronicling the epic story of America decade by decade from the 18th century to the 20th. Original music and immersive sound design accompany us on our storytelling journey. Listen to and follow History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Takeout. Political panel time. Isn't it exciting? I believe it is. Democratic strategist, CBS News political contributor Joel Payne. Republican strategist, T.W. Riggi. Great to have you here, gentlemen. Okay. Let's talk about Gavin Newsom, because it's an iron rule of this program. If I go to break before this segment and talk about it, we must talk about it. So I said Gavin Newsom. Axios says today that Newsom has spent the last 18 months, you can bring that up, control room, courting Biden and his family, publicly defending the ex-president's legacies as others have distanced themselves. Among the things that Governor Gavin Newsom says, I'll never turn my back on Joe Biden, one of the most successful presidents in the last century, masterclass of policymaking. Joel, while many Democrats run away from Biden, Gavin Newsom, I guess, feels he has no choice but to embrace what he said before and hold it into the future.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think feeling like, well, I'm already pot committed on Biden, so minus. Well, I'd also say one other thing.
Because if he tried to distance himself, all of his rivals and me and you and it would say, well, how about this quote? How about this quote? How about this quote, which stack up this high?
The political analysis that I would apply to this is there's one group of voters that Joe Biden, my suspicion is still pretty popular with, and it's black voters in the Democratic primary. And my guess is that Gavin Newsom feels like, hey, I want to make sure that those voters understand that I see the same political environment that they do. Joe Biden, my guess, would be rates pretty high with those group of voters than the rest of the Democratic
primary field. And when I talk to people in the Democratic Party who try to assess strengths and weaknesses for Gavin Newsom, when they bring up weaknesses, they say a potential problem with African-American voters, male and female.
That's right. That's right. I think that's completely right. I think the twist that he's going to have to deal with here is there's a very engaged group of online, organized, rank-and-file, progressive folks who show up in primaries who are not in those kind of southern states where it tends to be more heavily African-American voters who probably are not going to want to relitigate Biden.
TW, you don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but you're like, keep going, sir.
Absolutely. Look, there is something to be said that Joe Biden did win and put together a coalition of black voters, Latino voters, working class voters that got him over the finish line in 2020. But there is a quote of Gavin Newsom's after the debate, when the whole world, if they didn't know it already, saw what President Biden was dealing with in his mental decline, saying he's as sharp as ever, he should be our nominee, et cetera, et cetera. Just not sort of speaking the reality that everyone else saw. He's going to have to still answer for that. So why he wants to keep bringing it up when he's on record saying that is curious.
Yeah, but you're not going to use that against him.
Yeah. Oh, yes, we will.
I also mentioned this before we went to break, so we got to mention it. This is just happening, playing out on social media right now. Ro Khanna, Democratic member from member of Congress, and Elon Musk are in a bit of a fracas on X because Elon Musk has been on a torrent of things, calling him a robber, time to sue this liar, wants to put him in jail for all sorts of things that Ro Khanna has said about Elon Musk. This got Ro Khanna's attention so much so that he posted, guess what, a social media video. Control Room, take it away.
You know, Elon, I thought you were a free speech guy. Why not debate me on these issues instead of threatening lawfare? You're not going to be able to intimidate me. I'm the guy who stood up to the Epstein class and worked with Massey to get the Epstein files released.
Why this catches my eye, TW, is because Ro Khanna is making it clear that he is at least considering running in 2028 in the progressive lane. He wants a fight with Elon right now.
I thought you were going to say it's because George Santos came to Ro Khanna's defense, which was a little curious. But you're totally right. You want to go pick a fight with this guy with the biggest platform, at least on X, who's going to get you that media attention. I understand Elon Musk wanting to defend Doge, and I understand Ro Khanna throwing out crazy numbers about deaths related to
Doge. 4.5 million, he says,
right,
which is a result of Doge cuts to USAID.
Which is one study's projection over a long period of time. Be that what it may, that's not the point. I actually do think they should debate. There's few people who can defend Doge as well as Elon Musk. I'm all for that transfer of ideas. Ro Khanna is a good debater. I'd like to see him go at it.
Ro's a Silicon Valley guy, and my guess is that part of this is Ro, along with going after that progressive lane, also I think trying to represent Democrats, being able to maybe appeal to and speak to folks that I imagine Elon Musk might have a little bit more influence with. So I'm sure he doesn't mind the fight. And if you can't pick a fight with the president, the next best person to pick a fight with is the person who's the first trillionaire in the history of the world.
And you know, gents, the UFC thing is still kind of up on the South Lawn.
Go for it. I mean, my money's on
pay-per-view, whatever, you know. See, it's not all there, but there's enough remnants of it. Yeah. Maybe we can get something going there. That's just an idea. Joel Payne, TW Riggi, thanks for playing. Thank I appreciate you. It as always. Next, Glory, Grief, and the Gavel. God, does DC love alliteration. Former Kevin McCarthy aide Joe Ligansky joins the show to discuss his book on that marathon fight. We all remember it, January 23, 2023, to make Kevin McCarthy speaker. That's next right here on The Takeout. Welcome back. In January 2023, Kevin McCarthy was elected House Speaker after a historic and very chaotic 15 roll call votes. Former top McCarthy aide John Ligansky looks back on that grinding political process in a book called Glory, Grief, and the Gavel, an inside guide to running for Speaker of the House. I spoke with him about that process, elongated though it was, and a lot of other topics in American politics. Here is some of that conversation. The book is about the ascendancy of Kevin McCarthy to the speakership. We'll get to that, I promise you. But is it possible, John, that his removal as speaker was foreshadowed by the way he became speaker?
Perhaps, and I know I've heard that from a lot of folks. First of all, thanks for having me on,
sure.
Major. I appreciate it. But, you know, one thing we really understood innately with these tight margins is your job's on the line every day when you're Speaker of the House. You're at the mercy of 218 individuals, right? And so while the lot's been made about the motion to vacate, there's other ways to remove a speaker. You can just sit on your hands and not vote for a rule. You could do a discharge petition to remove a speaker. You could overturn the ruling of the chair that a motion to vacate's not an order. And so I think we got comfortable with the idea that, listen, every single day of the week, our job's on the line. We're willing to put our best out there and see what it led to. But we did have a group that was not going to go along, and I think we recognized that as well.
And that truism, that there were lots of different ways in which you could oust a speaker elected by your party, is that, from your vantage point, John, now that you're on the outside, something that any majority party who wants to run the House effectively better come to grips with? Because if your leadership lives in constant sort of fear that one or two discontented members can topple your speakership, how effective, how aggressive, how courageous can you be?
Yeah. Well, I think, and I think Kevin might have had to have been a sacrificial lamb for that cause, because we did see Mike Johnson as well face a motion to vacate resolution that thankfully a bipartisan majority of Democrats and Republicans stepped in and tamped down. I think if you gave truth serum to most House Democrats, they would admit that what they did to Kevin was not the right thing for the institution. But sometimes you have to touch the stove.
Right.
And we saw those 3 weeks where we didn't have a leader. It was very dangerous. You know, Israel was attacked in that period of time.
Right. The October House 7th
not,
happened.
Exactly. Just that weekend after, the House could not act. We were paralyzed.
Completely paralyzed.
And I think if you're a strong Article 1 advocate like I am, if you're an advocate for the House of Representatives, being a voice in this government, you should be an advocate for a strong speaker, whether that's Republican or Democrat. And so I think hopefully all the members that are around during that time internalize that moving forward.
Quick civics lesson. Article 1 enumerates the powers of Congress. That's why it's first, which I know you care about.
Yes, absolutely. And the first officer listed in the Constitution is the Speaker.
Right. So the title of the book is Glory, Grief, and the Gavel. Washington loves alliteration, so well played there. An inside guide to running for the Speaker of the House. Another title of the book could be, you have to be able to count and you can't quit. Subtitle, Matt Gaetz is a weasel.
I'm not a fan of Matt's. You do need to be
clearly,
able to count.
Clearly not a fan.
No. He knows that. And I say in the end,
he's portrayed as a weasel throughout the book.
Well, and there's a saying that I think is true. If you seek revenge, dig two graves. You know, Matt really wanted to stop us in January from becoming speaker. That's what I think the removal was about as well. It was not about policy, right? All those individuals that voted against Kevin, they voted for continuing resolutions seven more times in the 2 years that followed. So it was not about those issues. It
right,
was
because
about
Kevin was ousted, theoretically, because he agreed to have Democrats come aboard for a continuing resolution.
It was a 30-day government funding bill at a flat funding level, which, again, as I note in the book, we adopted seven more of those in the 2 years to come. So
it couldn't have been about that, is your point.
No, I don't believe it was. And
so what was it about?
Again, I think Matt had an agenda in January to stop Kevin from being speaker. He almost succeeded.
Yes,
I write about
did.
The book, about the 15 rounds, how we had to break them and go around him. But then I think he saw some discontent in the ranks and seized, you know, the option in the removal vote. But again, it led to his downfall as well. And, you know, the House suffered, obviously, in those 3 weeks. But again, I hope in the long term, folks see we can't go down that path again.
How do you evaluate the speakership of Mike Johnson?
I think he's doing a good job. You know, I'm a golfer. I don't know if you are, Major. But
I am. I'm a terrible golfer, but I do play.
Well, you'll like this saying.
One of my afflictions in life.
You'll like this saying. As a House Republican, I believe, you know, there's no pictures on a scorecard.
Right.
So it doesn't always look pretty, but if you get the job done, that's all that counts. And they've gotten the reconciliation bill done. They've gotten all the must-pass bills done. And so I think he's doing a great job.
And you have to play it as it lays.
That's right. That's right. And it's a very tight margin, right? No one knows that more than we did. And that's the newest, I think, facet of the House that people need to think about moving forward is the battlefield has shrunk. It's going to be one way or another, I think, give or take 10 seats in the House. And so you have to deal with the members you have. Any member wakes up on a certain day of the week in a bad mood, you got to deal with them. But Mike's doing a great job. I know a lot of people on his staff, they're doing a great job. And far be it for me to throw stones at the people that are in the arena.
You can listen to my full and very nerdy conversation with John Legansky on your favorite podcast platform. Happy Monday, everyone. This is The Takeout.
They're completely cut off from the outside world.
A new Paramount Plus documentary.
The narrative is we are a cult.
No, I'm doing this out of my own free will.
Gives unprecedented access to Gloria Vale, the controversial closed society in New Zealand.
38 charges of sexually offending children.
Wrong things have occurred. They do not define who we are.
Can't you just accept the fact that I love my life?
I need to destroy them.
Devotion, obedience or betrayal. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.